Anton. You're on with Jeff.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Anton. You sound very clear. Are you coming over a Skype line?
No. You called me in a rare moment that I sound clear. Uh-huh. Most people don't think I sound clear ever, but good.
Yeah.
No, I'm on a mobile.
Are you you mainly live in Berlin?
I spend time in Holland and in Berlin, basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Divided. Yeah. But I'm editing my. I edited the last film here, The Most Wanted Man, and also the new film I've just shot. I'm editing in Berlin.
Life.
Exactly.
And that's going to be opening sometime. What, in the spring or the summer, or what's the plan on that?
I'm actually not sure. I think it might be any of that, spring, summer, or autumn.
Okay. Very much looking forward to that one. Essentially, just to get over it really quickly, it's about the relationship between a Life magazine photographer who shot a few iconic photos of James Dean in 54, was it?
Early 55.
Okay. In the winter, and particularly though that wonderful shot of James of Dean walking through Times Square with a cigarette and the overcoat, and it's raining. That was great. That was an excellent shot.
Yeah, exactly. That's his most well-known shot of James Dean.
Right.
Yeah.
So I presume obviously there's some kind of story or whatnot, but I just I anticipate magnificent Anton Corbin photography and capturings. I think you're going to try and, you know, emulate the eye of a photographer. I think it'll be wonderful. I can't wait for it. So.
Well, actually, I don't want to disappoint you straight away, but I try to do the opposite in a way.
Oh, really?
I want the photographs to stand out in a way.
All right.
So not as to make the film look like the photographs.
Right.
It's more about the film is more about the moments he managed to get to take those photographs.
Right.
So it's in a way a bit like Most Wanted Men. It's filmed handheld, so it's a bit looser in color as well.
Right.
The
big problem, I'll just
very life-affirming kind of movie.
Okay, cool.
A bit of a contrast to my other ones.
Looking very much forward to this. I'll just briefly say that the problem with Jean Le Carré films, with the exception, I would say, of The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, and mostly the Jean Le Carré book does not stand very well up to the compression that a film requires, you know, boiling it down to 2 hours, whatever. I think the very best were the Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and Smiley's People, the long-form miniseries. But I think this is remarkable, A Most Wanted Man, because it really does, in a near-perfect way, compress the book and delivers the same kind of delayed satisfaction that Smiley's People did. Would you agree with my analogy about this and Smiley's People?
Yes, I guess. It does. I mean, they are very difficult to put in a two-hour film, the books. And a TV series seems to be quite a logic kind of solution to that.
Yeah.
So we had to drop some elements from the book in order to make this, and you know, make one of the figures from the book the main figure, the main character, and that's Bachmann. So you could lift the emotional side of it through him. But yeah, no, it's hard work, I'd say, put into a film, yeah.
I love the way that your film, very much like Smiley's People, just really doesn't tell you, it doesn't put it on the plate in front of you, what the shot is, like what's the interest about in this Chechen, half-Russian, half-Chechen immigrant with a beard and the kind of the vaguely creepy vibe with you know, his kind of Muslim Islamic mutterings. You don't know what's going on, just like in Smiley's People, until roughly the last 15%, maybe. But it's really great because of that. I love films that don't tell you, but you sense something's happening, but then it coalesces at the end. And to me, that's the mark of a truly riveting film, a film that snaps in at the end. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the attractions to the story was that the whole post 9/11 situation, you know, where the world is very polarized and we judge people very quickly.
Right.
Like the Isaac character will be judged very quickly to be bad. So I think that's not a great progress for us, but. Yeah, that's. I mean, that's why I wanted to make this film, because I think it has deals with our lives, and that's why I set the film in autumn, and that's why it has these colors.
Yeah, it's very much a mark of the 21st century realm that we live in, that when a character whom you're not sure about says the words "I have God," and at the same time renounces or professes no interest in having money. That right away tells you, in today's context, that the guy's probably up to something very suspicious, if not malevolent.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up as a son of a pastor, but I can see how much damage religion can do in the world. Or things in the name of religion.
Yeah. I think it's just and such excellent performances up and down. I mean, obviously everybody's been quite taken. It's probably one of the, obviously I don't think there's any question. It's one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's best. And but I was also very much taken with Rachel's performance. I thought
It's a different kind of performance for her.
Yeah. Where did you get the guy who plays Isa? Grigory Dobrynin. Now, where did you find
him? Yeah. Well, it's difficult to find somebody that fitted that bill. So we looked towards Turkey, the Balkan, for Eastern Europe in general.
Right.
And he's quite well known in Russia. And apparently he came very early on to one of the castings, and I dismissed him.
Yeah.
But then he came again, and I thought, oh, that's great. So yeah. I don't know what I didn't see the first time that I saw the second time. Maybe through the process of selection, I realized more what I was looking for. But he was a bit of a teenage idol there. And apparently he plays also in the next John le Carré film. So.
Okay. What's that one?
He's found his footing, yeah.
Uh-huh. You say there's another John le Carré film coming?
Yeah, no, I think they now see the strength of films. I think the legacy of John le Carré, they don't want just to be the books, but
right.
also to be films.
Okay.
And I think it's our kind of traitor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our kind of traitor, okay.
Yeah.
Nina Haas, I was particularly impressed with when I saw Barbara at the Telluride Film Festival. I think it was in 2011. Was that... What made you want to cast her, that film, or was it something else?
Well, I know Nina for quite a long time, and I actually had wanted to work with her in America, but it didn't work out.
Okay.
So yeah, I was very keen to work with her.
Yeah.
She's tremendous, you know.
Yeah.
And that's also what Philip thought. So we made Nina's role actually a little larger in the film than it was written initially.
Some people have noted that Hoffman's German accent is unlike any German accent they've ever heard. But the mark of a really strong and convincing performance is that the actor owns it, he or she sticks to it, and they don't budge from it, and you believe it, you go with it. Do you believe that? I mean, I thought his accent was fine. I mean, I don't know if it's exactly German, but it was. I thought it was wonderful.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's based on a little village about 50 kilometers outside of Munich.
Okay.
I'm just telling you that. So, you could make it up as you want to go
right.
long, but I think it's very believable. And like you said, it's solid the whole way through.
Right.
He doesn't fear from it, and it's just as believable as a German actor speaking English, I think. Yeah.
You know, something
they tend to have a bit of an accent, and they're all slightly different.
Right. Something that has been bothering me, Anton, I cannot remember. It won't stay in my mind. The name of the, without giving anything away, there's a shipping company that is alluded to twice in the film, if not three times, and it's called Seven
Friends.
Something.
Seven Friends.
Seven Friends. I couldn't remember the name Friends. God.
Yeah, because he says it when he looks at the computer, when he's in the car.
Yeah.
Seven Friends, and then his Nina's character says, "Is that all you have, Günther?"
Yeah.
And he says, "I wish."
Yeah. Yeah. Really quite, when that clicks in at the end, I said, this is my type of, you know, adult spy film that is I'm going to go see it again because I wanted to. It's one of those films you really need to see a second time just to appreciate it that much more, and your maybe some things you might have missed or some things that went over around you.
But also, I think sometimes, I used to watch sometimes a film twice just to watch the actor, you know.
Yeah.
Because you can just enjoy how somebody acts, right? And how he moves. And,
yeah, yeah.
But as a photographer, I guess I'm used to trying to observe people, and I do that with, you know, with actors. I love how they cross a room, or you know, but body language is such an important part of somebody's character.
You know? Yeah. You know, there Hoffman's character, a very wily German. Intelligence man is constantly medicating himself in this film, and there is not a scene, it seems to me, when he's not taking nicotine or alcohol or caffeine through coffee into his veins. It's constant medication. You can't watch this thing and not think about poor Philip and his tragic end from another addiction. It echoes, whether, I don't know, I don't think anybody intended it, but it's there anyway. There's no pushing it away.
Yeah, of course, you know, with the knowledge, in hindsight, you look at it slightly different. And I wanted to have that kind of character in the film, so it was meant to be like that. It's not like, you know, he thought of that, but it feels like it's an element of his own life is brought into the film.
What is your general feeling? What conclusions did you come to about the nature of the Islamic culture in the 21st century? The easy American right-wing view would be that all Islamics, all people from Islamic culture and Muslims, are probably to be not trusted, probably to be wary of, because there's something truly ballistic in that culture and in that mentality that wants Armageddon and that wants to take down the demonic culture of the U.S. You know, it's pretty relentless. But you lived with it as adapting it and making the film. Where did you come out at the end about the nature of his?
Well, it's difficult. I think any kind of fundamentalism is dangerous in our society, whether it's Christian or Muslim. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, it's always interesting that there's a lot of fundamentalism in America, but it's from a Christian side.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be the ones who want to fight the fundamentalist Muslims the most, because they're quite alike, you know.
Did you ever happen to see a documentary?
And I see that also between Israel and Palestine. I mean, the people, they're not that far apart, really. You know, they come from a similar source in a way, and they fight the small differences. And you see that also in between Islamic groups who fight in Syria or whatever. They have all their own interpretation, and they kill each other. And you see that in Iraq, of course, although it is certainly in the Shias. So it's mind-boggling to me.
Did you ever happen to see or hear about
the person believes, what the person believes would be enough to kill him?
Right.
That I cannot understand ever.
There's Adam Curtis has a documentary, a BBC documentary called The Power of Nightmares that was out a few years ago. Does that ring a bell? Have you ever seen that?
It's like, No.
It says exactly what you just said, which is that the neocons and the Islamic fundamentalists, the neocons in this country, I mean, which of course are allied or linked to fundamentalist Christianity and the whole right-wing community, that they are cut from the same cloth, and that they despise liberalism.
Well,
they want to roll the clock back. You know, the whole thing.
So that was indeed what I was talking about. So I'll look that up. What do you say? Nightmares? Something nightmares?
The Power of Nightmares. And it's a three one-hour segments by Adam Curtis. And it was Adam Curtis was turned on to me by Tom Luddy, who is the co-runner of the Telluride Film Festival. And he also made a documentary called The Century of the Self about the beginning of public relations. And it's a brilliant doc, and I think it says exactly what you were explaining. I mean, it says it exactly, right to a T. So. And I remember we all saw that documentary in 2004 in Cannes. It was a really...
Oh, really? That old already, yeah. Well, yeah, but I would be in total agreement with that, point of view.
So why is it shot in the winter, I believe, of 2012, correct?
Yeah, well, it was autumn, because I was very keen to have it in autumn.
Okay.
For me, because the producer wanted the film in summer, and I persuaded Philip to protest against that and towards autumn, because I felt the colors of autumn were very important to me in the film, and also just the leaves, you know, that sense of decay.
Yeah.
And I also, in a darker point of view of mankind, I felt that we entered the era of autumn in mankind.
Yeah.
So
mankind is in its autumnal era. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Your film made me fall in love with Hamburg again. I haven't felt this way about Hamburg since Wim Wenders' The American Friend, which also had that wonderful...
I was with Wim last week,
uh-huh.
And he was just regrading The American Friend. It was so great. He saw on a very big screen. So there's amazing images of Dennis Hopper again.
Yeah.
But that's the only film that I'm aware of that's a very Hamburg kind of film. And we were talking about how nobody makes films in Hamburg,
yeah,
in television series.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic location. But that was exactly my reference to what you just mentioned.
Yeah. What does it mean to regrade a film? What do you mean? Is it preparing it for Blu-ray, you mean? Or what does that mean?
Oh, I guess something like that. Yeah, he said he was regrading this all the work. Yeah, maybe for a re-release and stuff. Yeah, I didn't ask.
Well, just from a photographer's sense, to regrade something means to recolorize it or to rebalance the color. What does that term actually mean?
Yeah, probably. You know, you go to grading again to make it exactly how you want it to be, and maybe because there's some technical output that requires to gives you the chance to make it really be how what you want it to be.
Right. I told you before when we met in Toronto that I'll never be as in love with black and white film with black and white photography as I was with Control, and I hope that someday under some circumstance that you could make another magnificently pictorial film like Control in a black and white format. I just love your
taste. Yeah, me too. I mean, I wanted initially to make the James Dean film black and white, but that didn't work out. And now I think it's beautiful in color, but it's interesting. I mean, there was a black and white film out recently, which I didn't like the look of at all, but everybody hailed it as looking great. So
what was that?
There's so much difference between black and white. Well, I can tell you as a person, not for the interview.
I'll guess that it's Alexander Payne's Nebraska. You know that he shot that film. I didn't realize this, but they shot it in color. They have a color version of it. And he actually made the colors look kind of early 70s like Five Easy Pieces, that kind of color. And then I guess they converted it to black and white. I guess that was the thing.
Control was also shot in color, but I knew it was going to be black and white straight from the start. But the black and white film was just, I couldn't trust it.
Yeah.
The color process I could trust.
Right.
But it's still, you know, Nebraska is a polite black and white. I don't know, it feels like...
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It just didn't speak to me, technically.
You know, it'd be almost fascinating in a perverse way to be able to see the color version of Control. You don't have it on a disc, do you, or any kind of format?
No. I never made it a color version. I just straight away transferred it to black and white.
Yeah.
The grading before we edited it.
Well, it's really a perfect perfect film in its own right. I've got a wonderful Blu-ray. I think it's magnificent on the Blu-ray. And
oh really?
Yeah.
I've never seen it on Blu-ray.
Really?
Okay. Okay. No, I don't have Blu-ray. I never see anything on Blu-ray, but I've not seen it. But I will make another kind of version in 2017, I think, where I, because I have a lot of deleted scenes, you know.
Okay. Interesting.
So I want to put that together at some point and do a small booklet with it and
oh, wonderful.
And the 10-year anniversary kind of thing. Yeah.
That'd be cool. I remember. I'm amazed that you, of all people, a man whose pictorial eye is renowned, and you don't have a Blu-ray player to be able to savor films at their utmost. That seems strange to me.
No. You know, I know. I don't have that big a TV even. So.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm gonna have to let you down here.
Now you're gonna tell me that you have a 1995 TV with rounded corners, and you don't have a. You don't have a high def.
Not that bad. But my TV is at least 15 years old.
I love it. All right. That's great. All right, man. Listen, I look very much. I'm going to, like I said, see your film again this weekend. And I very much look forward to seeing Life when it comes out sometime in the first half of next year.
Yeah.
And lovely to speak
with you. Okay. Well, thanks so much for taking time
All right, man.
For the film.